My name is Mike Sperlinger. I'm the director of Prisms, and today I'm delighted to be in conversation with the writer Andrew Key, who is based in Sheffield in the UK. This conversation is in relationship to an event which is taking place in Oslo at Kunstnerhuset on the 31st of May. And the event is called Film Memories. It's going to be a screening and a conversation with the artist and writer Fatou Özbek. So Fatou is going to launch a zine version of some wonderful text she's been writing over the last few years, which she calls Film Rendringer, or Film Memories. And she's going to be speaking about that. And we're also going to watch a feature film by the French filmmaker Franck Beauvais called Just Don't Think I'll Scream from 2019. And I think what both of these things, Fatou's work and Franck's film, have in common is that in a way they're about the way in which films seep into our everyday lives, so that our memories of our lives are contaminated by the films that we watch, and vice versa, that we tend to remember films through the lens of the situations in which we saw them. In connection to the event, I really wanted to speak to Andrew Key. So Andrew's a writer I've been following now for a year or two, through his blog, Roland Barthes' Film Diary. It's a really extraordinary project, and I'm going to be speaking to him about it through the course of this conversation. But before we start, we're going to hear Andrew read one extract from the diary, just to give you a flavour of what it's like.
April 11th, 2021. Sunday. Elle and I go for a walk to the coffee van in Bingham Park in the morning. It's sunny and cold. I get a pistachio cannoli. We come home and it clouds over, and then it rains, and then it snows, and then it rains again. I spend a lot of the day trying to motivate myself to write the entirety of this week's diary, with limited success. I listen to a lot of The Grateful Dead to get me in the mood to write about American counterculture. It doesn't help. Eventually, at about 4 o'clock, I manage to finish. Then I go to the supermarket to buy some ingredients and spend 2 hours making some kimchi. The weather continues to rotate through all possibilities outside. After I'm done making kimchi, I watch Garlic Is As Good As 10 Mothers, directed by Les Blanc, 1980, a joyful, wonderful delight of a film about the garlic renaissance in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's really excellent, and an accidental continuation of this week's unplanned theme of US weirdos, circa 1966 to 1980. Les Blanc, the man who filmed Werner Herzog eating his shoe, goes to a bunch of restaurants in San Francisco, Oakland, and Berkeley, and talks to chefs about garlic and how great garlic is. One of these restaurants is my former local casual neighborhood eatery, Chez Panisse, where I would sometimes go to get steak frites and a glass of wine for $25 after 9:30 p.m. on a weeknight. Alice Waters talks about garlic a bit. Werner Herzog talks about garlic a bit. There's some footage from the Gilroy Garlic Festival. Everyone is smiling and delighted to be thinking about garlic. Occasionally, some people appearing in Vox Pop say they don't like garlic, and they are looked upon as if they're missing out on one of the deepest pleasures available to mankind. At one point, Les Blanc interviews a bunch of kids in a playground about garlic. It's a very Berkeley film. I won't get too much into my feelings about that because this week's film diary is probably already veering too close to full-on California nostalgia to be bearable for anyone other than myself. After reading Stanley Crawford's book, A Garlic Testament, earlier this week, which I really think is one of the best things I've read for a good while, I'm really getting a contact high from dudes talking about alliums. There's a kind of hearty new age back to the landism here, the organic movement, the health food movement, the kind of thing you'd expect in a film about food made in the Bay Area in 1980. But there's also a great moment which really resonates with me, in which some guy is talking about why fresh garlic is better than garlic powder or garlic salt or garlic infused olive oil, and he says something about the pleasure of the rhythm of peeling garlic cloves. And then he says, but, you know, it's hard to talk about that without sounding like a hippie dipshit. Right on. It is hard to talk about this stuff without sounding like a hippie dipshit. But that doesn't make it any less good. Garlic Is As Good As 10 Mothers is a life-affirming work. One of the best films about food I've seen. Not as good as Tampopo, of course, but probably nothing ever will be. Elle doesn't watch it with me, because she has a sensitivity to garlic, which means her pleasure would be spoiled. I would certainly not recommend this film to anyone who can't stomach garlic, unless you want to feel like a street urchin gazing forlornly through the window of a sweet shop you can't buy anything from. Except instead of sweets, it's garlic. And it's the life force of humanity. At least, if you agree with the hippie dipshits in this film.
I was kind of very excited to discover sometime last year Andrew, your amazing Substack. It's like an email newsletter, I guess we could say, or a blog. I don't know. How would you describe it?
Yeah, I think I prefer newsletter to blog, although I quite like the kind of web 2.0 nostalgia of the blog. But yeah, I think of it more as a newsletter than anything else, which I think captures the ephemerality of it, that it just keeps coming and it's not really about reading backwards into it.
Absolutely. And I love kind of getting it in my email inbox every week. And we should say, so that this newsletter is called Roland Barthes Film Diary. Do you want to just say, give a little intro about what is this project? What is Roland Barthes Film Diary?
Sure. So Roland Barthes Film Diary is, it's been going for about three and a half years now, coming up 3.5 years. And it's a project that I started in 2019 after a period of kind of uncertainty about the direction my life was going in, where I was watching a lot of films, and I had been watching a lot of films for quite a long time, and I started to realize that I had no way of kind of keeping track or really remembering how I felt about a film after I'd seen it. I wasn't doing much else. I was just kind of absorbing a huge amount of cinematic content. And I thought that it was a good way, I guess I had the idea to start writing about every film that I watched immediately after watching it, or as soon as possible afterwards, just to kind of keep track of my thoughts, but also to force me to write, to kind of generate words and to put them out into the world. I was having real problems with my writing in general and with kind of believing in it, knowing what to do, and getting things published was not really happening for me. So I thought, well, if I just publish myself, I'll lose the fear of the blank page, and I'll lose the fear of, you know, screaming into the void, because I'll just keep producing stuff. So I started doing it 1st of January 2019, and I've kind of carried on since then. It's an open-ended project, so I don't know when it's going to end, but originally it was just a few friends of mine reading it and a few Twitter followers, and it's kind of grown from there, which gives it a kind of propulsion of its own, really. I feel like there's an audience now that I have to kind of meet the demands of.
Yeah, I mean, because you actually wrote recently also that it's kind of just, it's kind of reached an enormous volume as well. You said, I think it was, you kind of totted it up and it was about 435,000 words.
Yeah, it's approaching 500,000. It's longer than Gravity's Rainbow, it's longer than Moby Dick. It's a huge amount of text to have written. Which is, I suppose, kind of interesting, because it's this generative practice in itself. You know, it took me a while to figure out the format of it and how it would work, but now I've reached a point where it almost writes itself. You know, I can watch a film and I know more or less I'm going to write 500 or 600 words about it. I have the style down quite neatly, I think. It's kind of evolved over time. So it has this sense of, yeah, it's a huge body, and it's kind of unusable for anything else. You know, I don't look back through it very often. I have this fantasy of it, one day it'll be finished and it'll be a book, but I've realized that it's kind of exceeded the possibility to be a book at this point, because there's so much of it and there's going to continue to be so much of it. But I think that kind of ties it to the everyday nature of the project, where, you know, it's very hard when you think about the everyday as a kind of aesthetic category to document everything. It's kind of impossible to document all of your experiences and everything, and just documenting every film that I watch ends up with this kind of gargantuan document that is kind of unusable, untenable. So I think that's contained within the project, of the infinity of the scope of it.
You mentioned in a way that you've developed a kind of style that's almost kind of automatic now. But can you say a bit more about that, about what it, because it seems to me like there's, obviously you spend quite a lot of time writing about the films, but there are other things that come in. So you write quite candidly about elements of your own life. You don't tend to write in detail about friends, although they kind of come in and out by name. But you talk about depression, bereavement. You also talk about very everyday experiences of different jobs. I think you're currently working in a care home, and then these elements are kind of interwoven within descriptions and kind of meditations on the films that you're watching. Can you just say a little bit about what it is that what are for you the kind of important constituents of the of an entry in the film diary? Like what are the and what for example what kind of things are the things that you don't write about that you very consciously exclude from it, for example?
So I think when I started the project, I had this sense of so much film criticism is just, it ignores the body of the critic. It ignores the idea that someone is sitting down in a room watching a film and they're also doing other stuff that day, and they've eaten something or they've drunk something or they're tired or they've got a hangover or whatever. It kind of ignores all that. So I was very keen to have the sense of, you know, when I watch films, I always feel different when I watch them. So a typical entry starts with the date and the day, and it usually mentions the weather, and it usually mentions whether I've gone to work or not, or what's happening with work. If I haven't gone to work, it will say something like, I do nothing today. There's a lot of doing nothing in it, or feeling distracted, or walking from room to room in my flat, picking up a book and not doing anything. And I tried to be honest about it. You know, earlier on, I was drinking more when the project started because I was less happy. And I would write about how I was drinking just to give a sense of, like, if I'm watching a film after drinking a bottle of wine, I'll have a different response to it than if I watch it sober. So I try and kind of give a good sense of where I am that day and what I'm doing. The film criticism itself does feel often to me like a kind of secondary part of the project. And I think there, a lot of that work is kind of about trying to unlearn the academic style that I had learned before I wrote the film diary. You know, I've read a bunch of critical theory and I really kind of internalized it for a long time as that's how to write. And I'm not really interested in doing that anymore. So I'm trying to write in a more casual, open, relaxed way. I would say kind of two of the big stylistic lodestars for the project are Dorothy Wordsworth's journals, where often she will be saying something like, I had a headache, William's working on his poems, Coleridge came round, read a bit of Milton in the evening, it was raining. Nothing really happens in the entries. And I suppose the other one would be Frank O'Hara, who his friends are always in his poems and they always kind of pop in and out, but they always remain centered around Frank O'Hara. So it's a kind of coterie, but the individuals who are also in the coterie don't seem to matter as much as the fact that they're related to Frank O'Hara through the social realm. So I write about my friends, but I don't really write about what's going on in their lives. I try and protect their privacy. I try and protect my partner's privacy to a certain extent, although that is kind of limited by the nature of the project. And I do try and be open about what I'm going through, but I'm very conscious of it as it's not a diary for my own use. It's a diary that has a public facing audience, and I'm always terrified that my employer might read it or something like that, my colleagues might read it. So I'm no longer working in the care home, but when I was very careful not to be specific about what would happen at work other than the vaguest things, just because of confidentiality and it's not my experiences to talk about.
That's very interesting, and you mentioned a couple of influences. And actually, at a certain point, this might be a while ago now, but in the diary, you actually mentioned a couple of others, which were slightly different, because you mentioned Derek Jarman, actually his journals as being referenced, and also, although you were somewhat sheepish about, but you mentioned Alan Bennett's writing in his diaries in the London Review books.
Yeah. And I still think, I was thinking about Alan Bennett's diaries earlier, and I was thinking that was probably the first thing I read where I encountered a public-facing diary that was very, seemed on the surface very open about what Alan Bennett, the elderly Yorkshire-based playwright, is going through day to day, his health concerns. But because they're not so full, they're very short, they're very kind of succinct details, you don't really get much of an insight into him. You get a kind of fake sense of an insight, a kind of spurious intimacy. And I think that's kind of what I have wanted to cultivate, the closeness, a kind of parasocial closeness with my audience, but keeping a distance while there are some things that I hold back. I don't talk about where exactly I work. I don't talk about a lot of details. I try and keep quite vague, just I think out of a kind of wariness of giving too much away. And also I think part of that is cowardice. Derek Jarman's diaries are definitely a big influence, and he wrote those partly for publication. But Boyd McDonald is another film writer who I find, you know, very influential, but I'm just not brave enough to write in that way, to be so kind of, especially in terms of sexuality, to be so open and so explicit in public, I feel like.
Because he was writing these amazing reviews in the 80s, right, in New York, which came out of the title Cruising the Movies, yeah. Where he's writing these kind of like very kind of sexually queer inflected, his kind of libidinal relationships to these films he's watching on late night TV about like Tarzan's loincloth and stuff like that.
But, yeah. Ronald Reagan's saggy ass is one phrase that I'll always remember. And I think that completely open attempt at writing your desire through the cinema, it's something that I've tried to do here and there in other pieces outside of the film diary, but I think for the greater part, the film diary remains family friendly. My mum reads it, my brother reads it, and I kind of want to keep some stuff back, I suppose.
Could you say a bit more about the background? Because it's interesting, because you studied in California. Were you studying film theory? Because it sounds like in a way there was a kind of academic training that you're actually trying to unlearn. Mm.
So I've never really studied film formally. I was at UC Berkeley in the English department, and in the program in critical theory. And I was in the US 2014 to 2017, and I came back after my dad died. But I really kind of used that as an opportunity to drop out of the program that wasn't really taking me in the direction I wanted to be going in. So when I was living in Berkeley, Berkeley has the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive, which I've read about constantly because I see it now as a kind of golden age in my cinematic education, because it's one of the best rep cinemas in the world, possibly. You know, there's constantly stuff on that you just wouldn't get a chance to see in the cinema otherwise. I saw all of Paul and Pressburger restorations within a 2-month period just after I moved there. And they did this thing where you could get a student pass for $40 and then go as many times as you wanted in a semester. So it basically was free for me to go to the cinema, watching all this great stuff, when I was also quite, yeah, unhappy with my academic work, quite lonely, far away from home, not really sure what I was doing. And so I kind of plunged into the cinema as a way of escaping from everything else that was going on. And the guy I was living with at the time was kind of baffled by how I could spend so much time watching films and how much of my time was given up to watching films and going to the cinema. Kind of sometimes I was going to 3 or 4 films a day, and he actually gave me the idea in the first place of saying you should write a blog about it, or you should start writing it down. But I didn't really get around to doing that until 2 or 3 years after I'd left Berkeley. And I never studied film really, only in kind of an incidental way in critical theory classes or other courses. I took one class on comedy and critique, which was taught by Anton Kays, who's a very serious Weimar film scholar, really respected. And for him, I wrote a paper on Paul Blart Mall Cop and The Pratfall as comedy. And that was really my only kind of interest in writing about film at the time, was, which I think actually feeds into the diary in a way of kind of all films are objects of kind of equal merit for film criticism. I can find something as interesting to say about Paul Blart Mall Cop, one of the worst films ever made, surely, as I can about Pasolini or something else.
Can you say a bit more about that? Because I think that's one of the most striking things about it, is that it doesn't feel like you're kind of ploughing this furrow or trying to kind of establish a canon, or that, you know, you write, you give the equal amount of kind of space and serious attention to Mamma Mia or Shrek 2 or Straubier or George Cukor videos or Lynn Sachs, or, you know, so there's that seems like a very, very conscious attempt to kind of flatten all of the things that come into your orbit and to treat them in a way without all of this machinery of, I don't know, kind of cultural capital or...
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is a kind of integral part of the project, because partly it comes from a frustration of the lack of space to publish that kind of work. I think it comes from a sense of honesty, I think. I think a lot of film critics with public personas like to... You either cast yourself as like I go and see whatever I'm told to see by the broadsheet publication that I work for, and I just review new releases, and there's no real sense of you having an in-depth knowledge or awareness of film history or the avant-garde or experimental works, more challenging outsider works. Or you're a kind of highbrow, serious film scholar who programs important works of the avant-garde. And it always felt like that was a kind of opposition that exists in film culture. Speaking as someone who's not really internal to film culture at all, I could just see that from the outside. And it was a frustration that I couldn't find a space to write about both kinds of film. And I kind of felt like I had to just make my own. But also wanting to recognise that, yeah, sometimes I watch Straubhulet and those films are incredibly important to me aesthetically and politically. But also sometimes I get drunk with my friends and watch Mamma Mia or Shrek, and that gives me as much pleasure or enjoyment or generates as much meaning for me as some of the more difficult, challenging, highbrow, serious films that I watch. I spent a lot of my academic life studying Adorno quite seriously, and I always have him kind of leaning over my shoulder, and I always think of that, you know, classic line often quoted of every time I go to the cinema I get stupider and worse. But for me, that is kind of part of the experience of recognizing that all of these films are ultimately aesthetic commodities, and they're all produced under the same conditions more or less of global capital, and there are ways in which you can navigate that, and one of them is to just recognize that everything can all go in the same pot and you can take pleasure from anywhere, and there's no real joy to be taken from a snobbish position of, oh, I won't watch that kind of things. Although I do have certain limits now that I won't watch new multi-billion dollar blockbuster superhero films, because it's just not fun to write how shit they are anymore. It's just, it's kind of lost the pleasure of the hatchet job.
One thing that's interesting, actually, thinking about that is that, and I might be wrong, but I don't get a sense that you often stop watching films, or you don't watch them in parts. So there does seem to be a kind of seriousness of, like, so for example, for myself, like, I find that often, especially when I'm watching more for distraction, maybe, that I'll kind of treat a feature increasingly like a TV series. Not, I'll just turn it into installments and watch it late at night for several days. But you seem in a way that that seems to be important to you, like the kind of maintaining the integrity of the film beginning to end, even if it is Shrek 2 or whatever, like and then writing about it immediately afterwards. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. There are a few occasions I can think of in the diary where I've given up on a film, and usually I will still write about it. One, I was commissioned to watch A Bug's Life, and I just couldn't make it through A Bug's Life. I've seen it plenty of times, I just thought, I can't watch A Bug's Life now. And I wrote about that. But I don't often give up, and I think partly because of the way that writing the film diary has structured my own film viewing, the idea of breaking the film into parts and watching it over a week or so just creates a sense of more work for me to do. I'd have to drag out writing the entry, and it's now reached a point with me where writing the film diary kind of determines the films that I watch in a way and how I watch them, because sometimes, you know, there'll be a new release out that I will think, oh, you know, I could watch that, but I don't really want to have a thought about it. I don't really want to have an opinion about it. I don't want to write about it, so I just won't bother. And so it's a limitation, but I'm definitely very keen to preserve the sense of films existing as kind of cogent wholes rather than arbitrarily breaking them up. Even though it makes it more convenient to watch them, I think I'm still quite invested in the sense of you sit down for 2 hours and you're in the film and then you're out of it afterwards.
You mentioned just now that sometimes you actually do commissions, and that's been a way of kind of relating to the audience. Can you just talk about that and about whether that's played out the way you expected it to, or, and how does it work in practice? Like, can anyone commission you to write something?
Yeah, anyone can commission me through Ko-fi, I guess that's how you pronounce it. It was basically an attempt to monetize the Substack to make it feel more worthwhile. So it costs £12, I guess it's about $16, and I will write 500 words about whatever film people want. Anyone can do it. It's a mixed bag. sometimes it's a nightmare and sometimes it's great. Sometimes I get to see stuff that, you know, I wouldn't have thought to watch before or that I haven't seen for a long time. I watched Scarface recently as a commission, which I'd never seen before, and I thought, I didn't love it. I thought it wasn't great, but it was good to have a reason to sit down and watch it, because it's the kind of film that I would probably never otherwise think, oh, it's time to watch Scarface, which is a film I associate with 18-year-old boys having the posters on their bedroom walls. But then sometimes people will commission me to watch stuff that I really can't tell what the impulse behind it is. So sometimes I'll commission something and I'll hate it, and I'll be dreading writing about it because I'll be thinking, oh, does this person love this film and really want to share it with me? And I'm going to say it's terrible, it's garbage. There was also a period where people insisted on commissioning anime films, and so I watched maybe 5 or 6 within a couple of weeks, and I'm just not very interested in anime, so I really found that a slog. And it creates a sense of obligation, but, you know, if I'm feeling kind of uninspired, it can be quite useful and it can be quite nice. There are also people, a few of my friends, who take a lot of pleasure in commissioning the worst films that they can find. So one, I can't remember who directed it, Sir Billy, which is like an animated Scottish film starring Sean Connery, which is just clearly like a cynical cash grab tax scam, which, you know, it sucked. It was 70 minutes of my life I'll never have back, but it can still be quite fun to write about that kind of work. It's a very mixed bag. I'm grateful for everyone who commissions something from me, but sometimes I think, why do I have to watch this? Why have I done this to myself?
And have you got to feel that there is a, like, do you have a sense of your audience? Like, and is there, do people also reply directly to some of the mails? Things like, is there a kind of feedback mechanism apart from the commissions?
Some people do. Yeah. Some people message me. And that's a mix of, you know, my friends who read it will message me directly about it. My friends' parents who read it will message me about it, which is very sweet. And then there are a few people. There's a guy who I think lives in Maryland, who I believe is a retired tax lawyer. That might be wrong if he listens to this and he can correct me. But he messaged me and said he's working through the entirety of the film diary from the beginning, and he's watching every film that I've watched and then reading what I've written about it as a kind of, I guess in his retirement, a kind of cinematic education, which is wild to me because there's no logic to it. It's not a syllabus. It's just what I happen to watch, which is very flattering, and kind of the kind of crazy idea that I really admire. I really respect someone for doing that ridiculous thing. Otherwise, it's very hard to tell. I know that some people discuss it, and I think that's amongst themselves. People that I don't know will talk about it, which is kind of a strange idea of it being a public facing thing that I don't know.
Like on Twitter or something?
Like on Twitter or in real life, you know. I know about, it's gotten back to me about people who, you know, they work in an office, multiple people work in an office, and they all read it, and then on Monday lunchtime they'll discuss what I've written that week. But then I think, you know, if I've had these periods of finding people online who are quite visible and becoming kind of fixated on them, and when blogging was bigger, when LiveJournal was bigger, I would religiously read people's blogs, and, you know, you get this sense of, oh, I know this person because they're putting so much stuff out, even if you never engage with them. So I can see the impulse. It's just strange to be on the receiving end of that impulse. But then I guess if someone was putting out a kind of enigmatic, apparently honest version of themselves to the world, it's quite appealing for people to latch onto. I can see why people do it. But I don't think there's a kind of big community of fans who are all discussing it together. I get very limited interaction with people who read it. But it's nice when people get in touch.
I mean, obviously there was also this kind of historical accident that I guess, like, just about a year after you started, that COVID happened. And
yeah.
That led also to a very particular climate of, like, film watching and a kind of intensity of this, experiences that we're having on our own in front of laptops and so on. I'm also aware that you've written recently of like feeling also like going through these cycles of feeling kind of burnt out with a project. Or do you have a sense of what the trajectory of it is? Like how did it draw energy from that sort of COVID moment perversely? And if so, like where are you at with it now? What do you imagine happening next?
Yeah, COVID was great for the film Diary. Probably one of the few things that actually benefited from COVID. You know, I was watching so many films, and having it there, I think if I tried to set it up in COVID, it would have failed. But because I already had it as a structure, it meant that I could use it to organize my time. So if, you know, I was unemployed during the first year of COVID, and if I watched 10 films in a day, it didn't matter. But because I was writing about those films, it kind of gave me a sense of purpose, or like I was not just squandering all of my time. Which is a useful lie, I think. So yeah, it was really, you know, COVID was really busy. I was watching a lot of films. I was writing a lot. The audience grew quite significantly. Since then, and since I've been working again and I've been writing other stuff more, it waxes and wanes. The last couple of months, I haven't been watching so many films, partly because of my work situation has changed a bit. I've been a bit ill, but also I kind of feel a bit run down with the project. I'm a bit exhausted of writing about films, and I've been reading more, I've been doing other stuff, I've been finding excuses not to write it. I think I'm at about 850 films. One vision I had was ending at 1,000, which when I came up with this idea sometime last year, if I'd have carried on at my going rate, probably would have gotten me until December this year before I'd stopped. And that seemed like a good time to end. But since I've barely watched any films the last few weeks, it's slowed down quite a lot, and 1,000 films feels quite a way off. But I don't really want to stop it. I don't want to end it, because it's a good project. It's useful. People like it. I do like doing it. But I think, yeah, it's very easy, if you do something over and over again, to feel exhausted by it. And I'm starting to think that that exhaustion and that feeling infuriated by the project is actually a necessary part of repetition. It's a necessary part of any project that focuses on the everyday, on everyday life, to realize that boredom, irritation, frustration, exhaustion are as much part of it as the kind of jubilant excess of, I've watched Mamma Mia and Strawberry this week and I'm having a great time writing about those things. So it will keep going, kind of indefinitely. My dream is at 1,000 films, then it can be a book, but I would strongly doubt anyone would take it on to publish, unless it's in an artist's edition of one, maybe.
Do you want to just say something briefly about your other writing? Because I know you published this novel, Ross mm-hmm. Hall, last year, and you wrote about writing recently as well. It sounds like you have another project on the go. Can you just say a little bit about that, about your other hats, about the other kinds of writing that you do? And
yeah.
What's exciting for you?
So I guess there are kind of three strands to my writing, including the film diary. One of which has kind of come out of the film diary is personal essays and film criticism kind of together. So recently I had a piece in the New York Times magazine about Jenna Rowlands and John Cassavetes, which really emerged out of the kind of writing I was doing in the film diary and trying to situate my emotional response to films and cinema in the context of a kind of critical register. And I've written about a few other films in that context. I have another essay about Elliot Gould's early career and Desire that's out there somewhere. Lugubrations, which is another really good Substack. So that's one strand of it that feels much closer to the film diary. And I'm kind of on a bit of a pause with that. I think after the Jenna Rowlands piece, I felt really kind of, I've said enough about myself for a while. I've kind of depleted the capacity for personal essays at the moment. So then there's also the fiction. So Ross Hall came out on Grand Iota earlier this year, and that's a book about Jean-Jacques Rousseau and his exile in the UK. It's very detached from film culture, but then I guess there's a relationship to the diary in that book of, it's about someone sitting down trying to write a book and struggling to write it. So in so many of the film diary entries, there's my sense of failing to write, being incapable of writing, and that gets channeled directly into the novel that I published. At the moment, I'm trying to write a second novel, which is much more ambitious. It's going to take a lot longer. I'm trying to rewrite the Bacchae, Euripides' Greek tragedy, the Bacchae, which has been written and rewritten a lot of times, but I'm trying to turn it into a novel. And I've been working on it probably for 2 years on and off. I imagine it's probably got 3 more years until it's done. I'm in a very slow period with that at the moment. Yeah.
Sounds amazing, though.
Well, hopefully when it's done, it will be, yeah.
Well, listen, great. Thanks. Thank you so much for speaking to me. We should say also that we'll have an extract of you reading one of the passages as part of this podcast. But you're also going to write, I think, next week about Norwegian filmmaker short film, Anna Haugsgaard's film, Life in Frogner. So we're very excited to see how that turns out and read it in the diary. And I guess we should just encourage people to sign up, right? They sign up at the... Where can they sign up for the newsletter for Roland Barthes' film diary?
Yeah, you can find it at rolandbarthes.substack.com. Roland Barthes is RolandBarFS. Named after the great French social critic, but with a undergraduate pun.
Great. Well, listen, thanks so much, and good luck getting to 1,000.
Yeah, thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.